Support for this day in esoteric political history comes from Odoo. What is Odoo? Well, Odoo is the only software your business will ever need. Featuring a suite of integrated business applications, Odoo connects your business operations together so you can get more done in less time. Odoo has apps for everything: CRM, accounting, sales, HR, inventory, marketing, manufacturing, you name it, Odoo's got it. To learn more, visit odoo.com/thisday. That's odoo.com/thisday. Hello and welcome to This Day in Esoteric Political History from Radiotopia. My name is Jody Avergan. Today's episode, a bit of an inauguration special. January 20th, 2021 is, of course, Inauguration Day, and that is our hook for this episode. We are going to look at a few notable inauguration days in the past, especially those that are, say, a little chillier than normal. In the past, three outgoing presidents, John Adams in 1801, John Quincy Adams in 1829, and Andrew Johnson in 1869, refused to attend their successors' inaugurations. A few other outgoing presidents have missed the inauguration for one reason or another, but those are the three that appear to be the most fueled by pettiness, if that's the right way to put it. And Donald Trump, of course, will add his name to that list. He will be the fourth to not attend his successor's inauguration. There have been other contentious inauguration moments as well, so we are mixing it up a bit and talking about a number of interesting moments on today's show. And here to do that, as always, is Nicole Hemmer of Columbia. Hello, Nikki.
Hey, Jody.
And listeners, that is not the only way we are mixing things up on today's show, because we are really excited to announce that starting today, we are adding a third host to this show. Kelly Carter Jackson of Wellesley is joining our team. Kelly, welcome. Hello.
Hello. Hi.
Welcome, Kelly.
How's everyone? Excited to be here.
Yeah, we are really excited to have you. And listeners, close listeners will know that you've been on with us a couple times before. But I don't know, this is your inauguration, Kelly. What do you want to say in your speech? You want to read a Robert Frost poem, or what do you want to do?
No, we have Maya Angelou on the phone ready to
I know, I have no poem, I have no speech, no quotes, no nothing like that, but I'm excited to talk. This is going to be great.
You know, one thing I will say is that, Kelly, people will learn kind of, you know, the kind of work you do, but, you know, you focus mostly on 19th century politics, and Nikki, mm-hmm. of course, focuses on 20th century politics, so I think we have a nice mix here, though we've talked also about how this is a really good chance for each of you to sort of step out and talk about stuff that maybe you're not an expert in, to which I say, welcome to my world, where I am not an expert on everything, and you will now have my experience.
Is anybody?
Exactly. But no, we're really excited about doing this together, and let's just start it. Let's start our inaugural term here.
Is there no swearing in? Is that?
Do you want to put, did you bring some book to put your hand on or so forth?
I did not bring a book. I can hold up my own book, Force and Freedom.
Perfect.
I swear on Force and Freedom, Black Abolitionists and the Politics of Violence.
Sorry, you got to get that plug in there.
That I will do no harm to this podcast.
So we'll go through a bunch of moments, but I do think the big hook for us is this 1869 moment. It is the last time a president skipped their successor's inauguration, and it is apparently, you know, a moment of real contentiousness between Andrew Johnson and the person taking over, Grant. So why, Kelly, did Johnson and Grant not like each other so much?
Well, I should just start out by saying that nobody really likes Johnson. Okay. Johnson is the first American president to get impeached. That's a really big deal. We should know that for a little bit of historical context, Lincoln selects Andrew Johnson to be his vice president as a way to appease the South. He is very much a Southern sympathizer. And so that rubs a lot of people the wrong way, particularly the radical Republicans who control the House of Representatives and the Senate, I believe, at this time. So when Andrew Johnson is leaving office, he's not too happy with his successor, Ulysses S. Grant, who is a war hero and beloved by the country. And so the November 1968, when Ulysses S. Grant comes into office, he wins by a slim, slim margin. The popular vote gives him a margin of just 300,000 votes. We can't even really imagine what that would look like today, considering that we call close elections with 2 million votes of difference. Right. But when we think about his inauguration, Johnson refuses to attend, and he and insists that he's just going to stay at the White House until the legislation is signed. And Grant basically says, you know, that he's going to reject the idea of riding in the same carriage with Johnson. And, you know, they cannot seem to get on the same page, which is really important because inaugurations are meant to show like smooth transitions of power. And so if we can't have everyone agreeing to be respectful, then it does pose some problems, particularly for the optics.
And we should say that 300,000 vote was not between Grant and Johnson. You know, Kelly mentioned how unpopular Johnson was. He wasn't nominated by either the Republican or the Democratic Party. He wasn't, I don't think, at that time, a member of either one of those parties. He was from the National Union Party, which was an artifact of the Civil War. But he didn't even get to run for election to the presidency because no one wanted him.
Yeah. This makes me think of, you know, Johnson here is the one saying, oh, I refuse to go to this ceremony. When in fact, Kelly, as you put it, it seems like everyone hated Johnson. It's a nice reminder that when you're the one who's like refusing to go to a party because you don't like everyone, there's a good chance that everyone whose party you're refusing to go to doesn't like you either. And that might actually be the dynamic. So, you know, maybe people were happy that Johnson wasn't there. Nikki, we also should say that Johnson didn't exactly have a good track record of performance at presidential inaugurations.
That's right. Of course, he was sworn in 1865 for Abraham Lincoln's second inauguration, and he had just been put on the ticket in 1864, so this was his first vice presidential inauguration, and dude shows up drunk. And, like, makes a big fool of himself. He goes out there. He gives a big speech about how he glories in being just, like, a common person. And I'm going to tell you here today, yesterday, in this place, the people are everything. And everyone around him is just like, shut up. You're so drunk. Like, Hannibal Hamlin is tugging on his jacket. And President Lincoln just, like, closes his eyes in that way that you do when somebody is being so embarrassing that you can't even look at them. So it was not a good first inaugural for him.
Kelly, this is Lincoln's second inaugural. This is the Better Angels moment.
Yeah, this is probably one of the most important inauguration speeches in American history. And so the fact that Johnson is causing really like a blight to this moment is embarrassing. And not just for Lincoln, but the Republican Party in general does not speak to a vote of confidence in who their vice president is.
Yeah. I love that notion of just like at every great moment in American history, you can just turn the camera slightly and there's probably like someone really embarrassing themselves off in the corner.
Some drunk uncle just over there holding forth.
And then someone also giving like a, you know, trying to admonish them or give them the side eye to like exit stage left.
Yeah. Somebody's got the shepherd's crook and is just pulling them off.
So one more thing just on this Johnson Grant inaugural. I mean, you know, it's icy. Someone skips it. Nikki, does that actually matter in any real sense? I mean, is it just symbolic or does it actually impede the way that politics was moving forward?
Yeah, I mean, the symbolism does matter. I think that that symbolic, peaceful transfer of power is important. But in the case of Johnson and Grant, I mean, this was a fight that had been unraveling over the course of the entire transition. So Johnson would reach out to Grant and Grant would rebuff him. Grant would reach out to Johnson and the same thing would happen. They were constantly fighting over what Inauguration Day would look like, whether they would take separate carriages, whether they would both show up at the same time together. And this was going on all the way up to Inauguration Day. And even though the size of the federal government was a lot smaller back then, it still mattered that they weren't able to talk about the business of government as they're handing it off to one another. So I do think that generally speaking, when there is this kind of crisis happening on Inauguration Day, it points to a bigger challenge that's happening with the transfer of power in the transition.
So before we get to other stuff, I mean, I do want to ask this sort of the big question for me here, which is, Kelly, I mean, you know, you talked about how it's important as a symbol, Inauguration Day. And I don't know, I go back and forth on that, you know, whether it is just pure pageantry and whether it really matters, or maybe, as Nikki is saying, you know, it's more like symptom than disease. But do you want to make the case for what happens on Inauguration Day actually matters?
Yeah, I'll say it is both symbolic and substantive. I think that people need to be able to see a smooth, clean transition of power, particularly in a democracy. I think that's incredibly important. I think that it's also important to see the swearing in of the president. You know, that is historic in and of itself, and people want to be a part of that moment. They want to say that I was there, I saw it, I witnessed it. So there's a lot of that. But I also think that when we think of American democracy as a whole, what makes this country so great is that we've been able to transition from leader to leader relatively with little drama. And that means something, particularly when you look at elections all around the world.
Right. And I think that, you know, one of these icy inaugurations that you were foreshadowing, Jody, was actually this first big one that showed how American democracy was going to work in 1801, the first time that you have a transition of power between parties. So going from John Adams to Thomas Jefferson, it was one thing for George Washington to just step down after two terms. It was quite another to have to hand the presidency over and all of the power that it had to your political enemy. And John Adams doesn't actually show up at Thomas Jefferson's inauguration. He is, in fact, until the very last minute, trying to stack the court with judges who are favorable to him. He's doing everything he can to exercise power until the very last moment. But that peaceful transfer of power, even if John Adams didn't get to witness it on Inauguration Day, is one of those things that made people in other countries look at the United States and say, oh my God, they're actually doing this thing. So it really does matter. It's a really powerful moment, and it's so core to what American democracy is.
I suppose it's also, you know, I guess a lot of the more famous speeches in American politics, presidential speeches, have been at inaugurations. I mean, it's funny. I think we've talked about this on the show, that actually State of the Unions don't actually maybe stick with people that much, but inaugurations certainly do. And so, you know, if you think that rhetoric matters, then that's an argument for its importance. And even, you know, Donald Trump, I mean, I think inauguration 2017 was probably the first in what seems like an infinite list of, like, is there going to be a tone change for Donald Trump? And he came out and gave that American Carnage speech. And I think it was like the first of many times where we said, okay, this is what it is. He is what he is. And we know where this is headed. So I will say that it does matter in that sense.
They set the tone, that's for sure.
For sure, yeah.
I mean, even if you think about famous speeches, I think of John F. Kennedy, you know, yeah. Ask now what your country can do for you. Like, that is cemented in people's minds in terms of, like, some of the most memorable speeches that people will give. But also some of, like, the pageantry and the performances, you know, who sings at the inauguration, who gives a poem at the inauguration, all of those aspects, who attends, who are the VIPs and the who's who, that matters as well. Yeah.
I mean, it is also, I guess, in theory, like, your moment of highest political capital. And it's like maybe your entire presidency is like the slowly deflating balloon from that moment on. But it's like you get to sort of say your piece with the most good faith, in theory, of anyone else out there. Okay, so let's talk about some other inaugurations. And we get to play this little rhetorical trick here where we said we're going to talk about icy inaugurations. And that means both tension on stage, but it also means weather, because we can get into this, but, you know, inaugurations, well, actually, the ones we've been talking about in the 19th century, those were in March, and we've mentioned how the inauguration date got moved up to mid-January. Inaugurations, Kelly, can be very cold, like, not just emotionally, like, actually very cold. And that actually has a pretty big effect on some of these.
I have only attended one inauguration, and that was the inauguration of Barack Obama, and I will say, I'm not likely to go to another one again. It was so frigid and so the amount of layers of clothing. And then, you know, half the time you can't even really see what's going on because you're behind thousands, if not tens of thousands of people. And so I realize now I can just watch it from the comfort of my home. But I do realize that, you know, we have to have at least, you know, a couple months for the new president-elect transitions team to figure out who they're going to put in office and how they're going to set up shop. But January is one of the coldest months of the year, and so it makes it incredibly hard, particularly when you're trying to organize large crowds of people outside. Yeah, it's not so great.
And even back when the inauguration was still being held in March, it's in D.C., and that does not protect you from having super cold weather. So Grant, who already had kind of a mess of an inauguration in 1869, in 1873, he's out there getting re-inaugurated. The temperature is 16 degrees. The winds are coming through, making it feel like minus 15, minus 30 degrees outside. And so not only is he having his inauguration, they have ambulances lined up so that the people who are attending can go get their frostbite taken care of, but he has his inaugural balls outside. So people are like in these heavy cloaks, they're trying to dance, everything's kind of frozen. They had 100 canaries that they had brought to serenade everyone, and they all freeze to death.
Oh my gosh.
So that's I will say that is an awful, inauspicious awful start to your second inauguration.
I killed hundreds of canaries.
Yeah. Whose idea were the canaries?
Well, this gets to something, because this show, and I think more people are feeling it now given what's going down in 2020 and 2021, but this show, I will give ourselves credit, we've been on the record for a long time that saying the gap between election and inauguration is too long. But this, there's a catch-22 here, because you don't want to move it up, it's still going to be very cold, right? You could say like, oh, let's make it in the summer, and where it'll be warmer. But you know, if you want to have your inauguration as close to after the election as possible, you're in a pickle unless you do it like in Florida or Texas or something in December.
You're going to have to shift the location or shift the election and the inauguration. Go. Move the election to June. Move the inauguration to August.
Exactly.
And it's a real pickle too, because you know you have the election at the beginning of November, you have the inauguration in late January, but then you have like five holidays stuffed in between there. So even trying to move it, you're running up against Christmas, New Year's, Thanksgiving. There's just no room for it.
Yeah, but it is true just in general. I mean, I think something is broken with transitions. And I think something needs to change there, especially now, like, you know, we've talked about on the show that the gap was there because sometimes it would take a long time for information to spread and even for the winner to be announced. And we're living in a different era. You can call the election, and then I think there does need to be some time, but I feel like...
What do you think, a week, 2 weeks?
I think New York is still counting votes, so...
Right, that's true. No, and I mean, when you hear about functioning transitions, not the one that's here, it really is like a massive amount of transfer of information. But I just think that Americans, and I will count myself among it, are like, when we have a new president, they should be able to just get their hands dirty and go. So I don't know exactly what the answer is. Smarter people than us will hopefully figure it out or not figure it out. Let's talk about the 1961 inauguration. This is one of my favorites. This is JFK, Ask Not, as Kelly mentioned, very famous. But a couple other things happened that inauguration that I don't think people realize. One of my favorite moments, the podium that people were speaking from, briefly caught on fire due to an electrical short in the power system while Cardinal Richard Cushing was delivering the invocation.
When stuff catches on fire in the middle of a prayer, like, it's not a good sign.
I know. Can you imagine praying with your eyes closed? You know,
all of a sudden you smell smoke.
And then smelling smoke.
Yeah, that's possibly a sign. And then the other thing that happens is Robert Frost famously does a reading at that. And I think Frost was very old at that time. And Kennedy really had to sort of convince Frost to come and give. And Robert Frost gets up there and tries to read. And there's snow on the ground. And apparently the glare from the snow made it so that he couldn't even read the pages in front of him. And Johnson went up and tried to like shield him from the snow. It didn't really work. And so Frost ad-libs and like switches poems and reads from memory the end of a different poem. And people, I think, picked up on it and really liked it and applauded. But again, you know, live events are very hard to stage, I guess.
Yeah. And when you try to overmanage them, you end up with something like Richard Nixon had in 1973, when he was so worried about all of these pigeons making a mess on the parade route. He has them go through and use a chemical bird repellent along the route. And I mean, it gets rid of the pigeons in a sense in that it kills them all. But it means that as people are on the parade route, there are these dead birds everywhere. Inaugurations are not good for birds.
Oh, gosh. I will say this. If there's one president that was kind of like, we're not doing this, we're not dealing with the cold weather, it's Ronald Reagan's second inauguration. So in 1985, winter weather was so cold that he basically said, we're taking this inside the Oval Office and inside the Capitol and canceled the inauguration parade. That to me sounds like a plan.
Yeah, it's just like, hundreds of years of American history, and he was the first one who was just like, maybe we just go inside where it's warmer. That's revolutionary. And then I want to mention one other sort of interesting moment, and then I want to start to wrap up with some kind of bigger thoughts about where we are now. But, you know, there was, you mentioned Barack Obama in 2009. There was this moment, and I guess I was covering the election at that point. I think I was down there, but then I remember also covering it for WMIC, so I don't know what was going on. But John Roberts, who administered the oath, tried to do it from memory, and he screwed it up.
Oh, yeah. And, I remember that.
And Obama did this interesting thing where I think caught in real time that Roberts had screwed up, but he didn't correct him, which I think would have been like a big moment in and of itself. So he goes along with it and recites the wrong oath. And I think there was a moment, you know, a number of hours technically, where Obama had not been formally sworn in because he did not recite the oath properly. So again, you know, these are humans. They are petty. They screw up. They forget their reading glasses. They light podiums on fire. You know, all sorts of things can happen.
I remember that. I remember that gaffe. And I also remember there were pictures of him and video footage of him like being sworn in officially to rectify the fact that they had gotten the oath wrong, which seems insane to do. But given all of the, you know, hoo-la-la over his birth certificate, I think he was like, listen, we cannot get this wrong.
Like he had by that point known that every loophole would be exploited. And so he needed to,
For sure.
All right, so what do you think about this year? Look, I mean, it's hard to say what will transpire on Inauguration Day itself. But, you know, Kelly, where's your head at in terms of what this Inauguration Day might look like? And again, to this notion that it is important symbolically, What is being symbolized in this moment as you see it?
I mean, this is the first inauguration during a global pandemic. So I think a lot of things will look different simply because of the fact that there will not be any inaugural balls. They won't be, you know, sort of the massive gatherings that we would normally anticipate. And then giving all of the violence and protests and riots that have taken place, I think a lot of people are feeling a bit conflicted about what this inauguration means. I myself am not quite sure what to make of it or how historians will look back on this moment in 20, 30 years and say, oh my gosh, was this not insane? Or, wow, we managed to really make something nice into something that was crazy. So I'm not quite sure, but I'm definitely looking forward to watching it. There's been all kinds of memes and jokes on the internet. Someone was like, they should just send Biden and Kamala Harris a DocuSign and tell them you're officially sworn in. Like, but it's, I think people are also worried about violence, another attempt at violence.
Yeah, look, I mean, this is an inauguration that is happening without a peaceful transfer of power. And it is going to look like that. The pandemic obviously means that there won't be very many people in attendance, but you know who will be in attendance? The National Guard. And I think that that is an imagery that is both going to be startling, but also is going to be a real reflection of the conditions under which the inauguration is being held.
Yeah, that's where my head's at, too, that just the exact symbolism of an inauguration, which is, you know, in theory, unity and welcome. This is the people's house and the people are there and your leaders are here and everyone's there together. I mean, that is exactly the thing that's being stripped for understandable reasons, the pandemic and the threat of violence. But we've talked about sort of my love for state houses before and state capitals before. But, you know, just like this notion that you can walk up to this space and it is your space. And that in the last couple of weeks has been ripped from us. And I think it's a shame that the inauguration will not start to do work to rectify that. That said, you know, I think the important thing is that it's safe and that we move on. And I don't think anyone expected a normal end to the Donald Trump presidency. So there you go. Yeah. All right. Well, let's end our podcast at the very least there. Nicole Hemmer, thanks to you as always.
Thank you, Jody.
And Kelly Carter Jackson, thanks to you. And we will see you next episode and the episode after that and the episode after that. Thank you.
Looking forward to it.
This Day in Esoteric Political History is a proud member of Radiotopia from PRX, a network of independent, listener-supported, artist-owned podcasts. Our researcher and producer is Jacob Feldman. Our producer is Brittany Brown. Kaula Nakua helps with our transcripts, which you can find at thisdaypod.com. I will also say that we just slightly revamped our website at thisdaypod.com. There are now bios for the three of us and our producers, and you can just learn a little bit more about the show on our site. thisdaypod.com. You can also email us through that site or thisdaypod@gmail.com with any questions or comments about the show or any welcome messages for Kelly. Leave us a rating or review on Apple Podcasts. Thanks to everyone who has gotten in touch with comments and suggested topics and more. My name is Jody Avergan. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you soon.
Radiotopia. From Pete.